Welcome to the news for the week of 14 June 2020. Cute robot dogs available for sale. T-Mobile was down all day yesterday. Bugging light bulbs. DARPA. And eBay, well, they're going to get you. All this and Bob Erdman from Core Security Help Systems going to join us on Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly. For security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News. As technology continues to evolve and expand, so have the countless ways our critical systems can be put in jeopardy. Ransomware attacks, misconfiguration, user error, and malicious threat actors, to name a few. As IT infrastructures continue to grow and diversify, how do you ensure stable security? Core Security, a help systems company, provides an analytics-driven, layered approach to security with a portfolio that enables both proactive and reactive responses. With Core Security, you can reduce risk by limiting access, detect upcoming and active threats, test for security weaknesses, and efficiently monitor data for actionable insights. To learn more, visit securityweekly.com/core security.
All right. Well, in a year of craziness, don't let the craziness get you. Yesterday, T-Mobile experienced a massive outage in the United States. If you look at the map, it looked kind of like the COVID map. So yeah, it's on the screen. The outage started about noon, and it looked like it was still going on when I went to bed this morning. So they were still having problems. So immediately, I mean, on the heels of this, a whole bunch of stories popped up, ranging from everybody from Anonymous and on and on and on, about that this attack was a distributed denial of service attack that was probably being prolificated by a nation state. It was the end times. It was World War III and IV combined into World War V, the rewarning. It was all kinds of things all rolled into one. Maybe the rapture rolled in there. You name it. It was all about to happen. The CEO, however, from T-Mobile said that it was an IP traffic-related issue that reduced capacity. Now, of course, immediately, this resulted in a whole new round of conspiracy theories that the CEO was actually a lizard person from another dimension, all kinds of things like that. But basically, you know, it wasn't China, apparently. It wasn't the Koreans. It wasn't, you know, the new Korean War, anything like that. Quite a few people then, security experts rather than conspiracy experts, started talking about how there was really no evidence of a distributed denial of service attack on this level. I mean, distributed denial of service attacks are going on constantly. I mean, every day, all day, they're running all over the place. But if you ran a distributed denial of service at this magnitude to cause that map where it's just like covered in attacks, there would have had to be some kind of, you know, impact on other systems besides T-Mobile. So basically, it made what the CEO said about it being some kind of IP issue sound a lot more realistic. So my suspicion is that it's probably an IP problem internal. It's probably one of those things like we've all been there. I changed that ACL rule and now the whole company's offline. Maybe I better roll that back, but I forgot how to roll it back because we didn't have a plan. The Federal Communications Commission in the United States has indicated that such an outage was unacceptable, whatever that means, and that they would subsequently investigate. So I'm sure at some point in the future they will use that. So use common sense when you hear these end-of-the-world stories, especially on Twitter. I mean, come on. And the University of Negev is at it again. Tempest is real, folks. I mean, everybody keeps telling me about that. So this time, these guys, this time they used an electro-optical sensor on a telescope and aimed it at a light bulb. Okay, so they have a light bulb in a room, and two people are talking. They aim the electro-optical sensor at the light bulb, and they pick up the sound wave vibrations in the filament and then use those with the audio to digital convert, or digital audio, or I don't know, one way or the other. Forget it. But basically, they took the vibrations of the sound wave, converted them into something they could hear, and they were able to snoop on the conversation from a distance. So, Tempest, here we go. Now, it probably not that big of a real world threat. Like a lot of the things that these guys do, the coolest experiments, but like a lot of their experiments, it was done in a lab. They immediately said that there's all kinds of, you know, like the glass on the light bulb and the type of filament and, you know, the window that was, you know, between you and on and on and on. So, you know, but it should make you more aware that there is an OSINT threat from looking through windows. It was something we used to do when we did physical pen tests, was scan all the windows with binoculars to see if we could see passwords. And we did one time see passwords for the network written on a piece of paper stuck on a filing cabinet. So can you say Vanek freaking? I surely you can. If you don't know what Vanek freaking is, well, look it up. All right. I mentioned this last week, but I'm going to mention it again because it is cool. DARPA is now running its first bug bounty. So basically, it is focused on what's called Sith, which is a hardware security architecture that is used to prevent software exploiting hardware vulnerabilities. This is something they've been developing in conjunction with, like, the University of Michigan and some other people. The program, though, for this bug bounty is called FET, F-E-T-T, which is for Finding Exploits to Thwart Tampering. You got to have an acronym. It's the government. So I did put a link to the DARPA page. So if you want to check that out, you can, or you want to get involved in the bug bounty, you can sign up there and you can get involved in that process. So that should be fun if you're interested in such things. Trek TCP/IP stack was reported as being vulnerable to at least 19 vulnerabilities, and those 19 vulnerabilities are called Ripple 20. So I'm wondering if they're holding one back. But this came from JSOF. Trek, if you aren't familiar with that stack, is the stack that a lot of IoT devices use within their operating systems to communicate to the network. So this Ripple 20 exposes all these IoT devices to everything from remote code executions to distributed denial of services to exfiltrations, you name it, something's in that Ripple 20 collection of exploits that goes along with Trek. Ripple 20 vulnerability then appears in over 100 different brands. And that includes Cisco, Dell, GE, Honeywell, HP, Lockheed, and I could read the whole list, but that would take the rest of the day, so we won't do that. So basically a lot. So again, this is more of the same in terms of IoT, and when you embed these devices across your enterprise, they have lots of different components. Those components may have been assembled from other components and other components and other things. So you definitely need to test this stuff before you turn it loose in your enterprise, or you may have all sorts of holes in your network that you weren't expecting because somebody can just literally sit in the break room and access your network through the IoT network. You want Skynets? This is how you get Skynets, I'm telling you. Now, while I'm not as paranoid as a lot of you listeners, and I'm pretty paranoid, and it's not paranoia if they're really out to get you, but Norway did suspend their virus tracing app yesterday due to privacy concerns. So imagine that. I mean, a lot of us were talking about these contact tracing apps all along. I'm on several committees and groups that are reviewing contact tracing apps. Rapidly developed applications that were developed in times of extreme duress that collect behavioral information from people's personal communications devices, how could that ever possibly have privacy issues? I mean, you know, say it ain't so, Joe. But I mean, so this particular app is called Smittestop. I don't know how to say it, so I'll say it with a funny accent, and maybe that makes it okay, or maybe that makes it racist. I'm not sure. But either way, it was supposed to collect movement data, which was going to help the authorities trace COVID-19. So this is just like all the other apps that we've seen. It's using Bluetooth. It's using your phone. It's using all this stuff to create a database of who you've been in touch with and where you've been. Now, different companies have expressed all sorts of, we would never do that. We would never collect data on you. We would never sell that data. We would never release that data accidentally. We would never let that data get hacked. We would never use an S3 Bitbucket to store stuff with an open privilege. Yeah, and of course, they would never do that. About 600,000 Norwegians did download and use the app. That's about 11% of the total population of Norway. The story didn't exactly say what the privacy violation was, but they did say that it used centralized data storage. And of course, the minute I hear centralized data storage, I hear centralized data storage hack, you know, because I mean, that's the whole, you know, that's the whole thing about centralized data storage. Anyway, Norway says they are deleting all the information. They're going to salt the earth so that nothing will ever grow there again and everyone will be safe. Now, France and the UK have similar apps that may have been developed, but I don't know where they were all developed, but they were very similar. They do the same thing. They store all this stuff centrally. Well, at the same time, Amnesty International has already released an article calling out COVID-19 tracing apps in Norway, Bahrain, and Kuwait, that they are very dangerous to the privacy of people living in those places. I don't know how dangerous it is in Norway, but some places it may be more dangerous. And they're urging the governments that were on their list to go ahead and get rid of the apps that they were using because they were endangering the privacy of individuals. They did not, however, actually do any testing or analysis of apps being used in the United States, but you can sort of extrapolate from that. And then this one's just weird. I mean, I read this story. I thought it was a joke. I literally looked to see if it was like by The Onion or something. But this is like crazy. So listen to this story. So eBay, eBay's security team. This was, and I'm not talking about, it was like a couple of teenage kids in the basement. It was eBay's senior level security team members were involved in a cyber stalking campaign. So apparently, this couple who writes an e-commerce newsletter from Natick, Massachusetts, they published this little newsletter, criticized, I don't think it's a little newsletter, it's like worldwide or something, but they criticized eBay more than once. I mean, you know, oh no, criticizing eBay. So listen to the list. So the senior director of safety and security, the director of global resiliency, the senior manager of global intelligence, the manager of global intelligence center, and the senior manager of special operations for global security, and an intelligence contractor. I the names and ages of all these people, and I don't know, pictures of them or whatever, all in the story, so if you want to find out, but who cares. They decided to hack back. I don't know. Apparently, a text was sent in 2019 by two eBay executives that said it was time to take down this newsletter. And so basically, these people who are high-level senior execs in the security infrastructure of eBay started harassing the people who made the newsletter. And the harassment included things like sending them live cockroaches in the mail, sending them a funeral wreath, a bloody pig math. Math? I mean, it's math. It's me. A bloody pig mask. I don't know what bloody pig math is, but it sounds pretty interesting. But they did all this to their home. Then it got weirder. Basically, it just kept going. They went to their home. One of the members of this senior team, who was a former police officer in like San Diego, went there offering to help them stop this harassment, and in the process was actually spying on them. The whole team, or some group of the team, went to their home and broke into their garage and was installing GPS trackers on their vehicles. And I mean, this was like Tiger King or something. I mean, it got so crazy. I really was watching the story, and I just kept expecting people to, you know, to start doing the Tiger King thing, going, I don't know, man, I sure do like tigers, but then I started smoking meth. I didn't know what was actually happening here, but it was a massive campaign against these two people that also included doxing them on Twitter, threats that they were going to come visit them, you name it, but all this because of a couple of criticisms of eBay in a newsletter. Now, it's pretty big. But hey, apparently don't criticize eBay or they're going to send SEAL Team 6 to take you out. So I'm probably at risk at this point. When we return, Bob Erdman from Core Security joins us to talk about ransomware. So stick around.
The question is simple. Have any of the systems on my network been compromised? The answer is harder than it should be. Enter AI Hunter. Active Countermeasures has automated and streamlined techniques used by the best pen testers and threat hunters in the industry to create AI Hunter, a network threat hunting solution that does the first pass of a hunt for you to identify systems that are most likely to be compromised and scores the results on a scale from 0 to 100. You can then research those systems in depth with AI Hunter. Focus your valuable time on the systems that need your expertise with AI Hunter. Sign up for a personal demo today at securityweekly.com/ACM.
Welcome back to the Security Weekly News. Bob Erdman, who is a senior manager of product management at Core Security, which is part of Help Systems, joins us. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being here. We always like to talk to exciting people in the industry, and you've been doing this for a while, right? I mean, you said in your bio like 25 years or something.
I have been. I've been doing this for quite a while. A lot of experience in the healthcare and military in my earlier days, and now focused over here with Help Systems and Core Security on, you know, pen testing, network traffic analysis. So both sides, offensive and defensive now.
Cool. So, I mean, you've been around a while. I mean, you remember the days when like hacking back stuff was like a thing? I mean, when I first got involved in this, it was a thing.
Yeah, back before it was easier to get caught. Everybody thinks they're not going to get found, but
it wasn't even illegal. Yeah, it was like, I mean,
extremely illegal.
No, not when I was doing it. I mean, this was before they had any legislation about it. I mean, they were still prosecuting people for tax evasion and stuff back then. I mean, we never really hacked anybody. We just sort of fired shots at them, you know, like you run a big denial of service against their website or something and say, hey, I see you. Why don't you go away? And usually they would, or they would call you.
Yeah.
Because I did that a couple of times. I got like a university from Australia called, and they were like, I didn't even make an attempt to hide myself. I was like, look, you know, you guys are attacking my network. I'm going to blast you. And then they like somebody called me, and they were like, why are you attacking us? And I'm like, because you're attacking me. And they were like, oh, we'll look into it. And then it stopped. And I was like, okay, yeah, sure, you bet. All right.
Beats me too much, but putting on the robocaller at their corporate phone number to
A good one. Or even, I remember just using a modem to set it on auto dial and have it just dial. Yeah, that was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. That's illegal. All that stuff's illegal now. You can go to jail for it. But back then it was okay. All right. So can you believe that eBay story, though? I mean, that thing just freaked me out. I read this story like 3 times. I was like, what?
That's crazy. And of course, it's high-level people inside of that organization, too. It's not like the guys they hired last week.
I'm still just kind of like, I mean, I literally thought it was a joke. I was reading it. I was like, is this like some gag article? So I like cross-checked it because I was like, I want to report this. And if you were going to go, oh, you got sucked into that. But it was apparently true. It's like crazy. I don't get it. That was really weird. All right. So you're the ransomware guy. Which is cool. I mean, one of the biggest things we see out there in the marketplace now, so much that we hardly even report on it anymore is ransomware. I mean, I could have picked 15 ransomware stories for today and just read them for the whole news show. What do you think the biggest ransomware threat is right now? Is it Ryuk?
Yeah, I mean, and we're seeing Tycoon being really bad. And, you know, usually I think what a lot of people are finally learning is that most ransomware attacks are actually data breaches up front. So, you know, people are getting in, they're living in those systems, they're stealing everything they can steal. And when they exhaust that monetary value out of those networks, then they light the network on fire and ask for a ransom demand to get it back. So I think more and more organizations are finally coming to that understanding that ransomware is usually the exit point. It's not the entry point. So as we're seeing these organizations, you know, learn how to better protect themselves and really take a better look at what's going on inside of their systems, you know, that's really what we're looking to protect against. You and I were chatting a bit too. It's people that think they're immune. I'm on systems that can't have ransomware. Wrong.
But they do. I mean, I ran into that all the time as an auditor. They didn't need controls because their system was, you know, impervious to attack or whatever. And I'm like, is it in a vault at the bottom of the ocean and not connected to anything? No. Okay. So it's not impervious. It's whatever the opposite of impervious is. Pervious, I guess. Which, that sounds bad. Like, pervious. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, I'm glad to hear you say that, though. I wrote a white paper about something like that, internal kind of thing, maybe a year ago, talking about just what you said, which is that this was throwing the match over your shoulder as you walk off the scene, you know, that the ransomware is just there to hide all the activity that you did and maybe ruin the forensic data and do all this kind of stuff. And I get the pushback on that. People are like, why would anyone do that? And I'm like, why would they not? I mean, this a ransom, how much money are you going to get from these ransoms? And when you could actually, you know, exfiltrate all this data and be in this network for a long, long time, and then when you think you're about to get caught, you walk out the door and toss the match. So, yeah, I'm so glad to hear you say that. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the movement of this stuff into, like, this sort of what I call a framework model? So, like, we saw Revil, you know, now putting up an auction site on the dark web to sell the data. I mean, I get why they're auctioning because it encourages you to pay, but do you think this is going to keep going into almost a commercial world?
It certainly seems like it will. It's going to help to, you know, try and force people to pay. Maybe I think I have great backups and I have great ways to recover. I'll just take my time and reload. But if my data is out there for sale now and I can get that extra nudge to, maybe I should just pay before they, you know, let the secrets loose from my company or my intellectual property. You know, that's good for me as a ransomware vendor. And we've seen a lot of that with just people selling that framework to increase the capacity of their ransomware operations. If I can go out and buy that service, give you 50%, I don't have to worry about writing it. I just got to find somewhere to deploy it. That really helps me and it helps you. So we're continuing to see those increases as well.
Do you think that the shifting nature of, I mean, I keep seeing, you know, every week now you see a bunch of stories where they say, oh, now there's this framework and it's been modified into this framework. And now this is a dropper framework, you know, like Emotet or TrickBot is a dropper framework. And you know, I mean, do you think that's going to just turn it into a thing where we really are almost just completely susceptible to it? I mean, at least at the drop level. I'm not talking about how we can prevent it from doing anything, but.
We see a lot of intelligence on that backside. You know, everybody used to think I'm on Windows. That's where you have to make those concerns and that's where you have to be worried. We do deal with a lot of people that have a very, their networks are not heterogeneous. They have lots of different types of systems and those droppers are getting very intelligent now. So once I'm onto that foothold, I can kind of evaluate where I'm at. I can tailor what I'm going to deploy. You know, a lot of this stuff is almost unique to the deployment these days. They can build those things so fast on the fly. So if I have something that's seeing Linux on the back end, I'm going to drop things for Linux. I can drop things for Windows on the other side. And it's really going to let me expand that footprint. And we see that on the back end a lot with people that contact us where they're suffering from a reinfection cycle where they get it, they think they've cleaned it up, and 6 weeks down the road, they're infected again. And it's because it's pushing itself into so many nooks and crannies on the network, they're resolving the easy to find stuff. And as soon as they think they're done, they're getting reinfected back from those other locations. And it kind of lights that whole fire again on their side.
That's what I would do. I mean, I always, I'm a white hat, but I mean, I always got paid to think about, you know, like how would somebody do this or how would, you know, it's like disaster planning. And I mean, I would definitely try to hide things that were well hidden that would reactivate later. So now you do your restore and I go, oh, you didn't pay me my ransom. You think you're so clever doing a restore? I mean, I can just see that thought process is like, oh, you're going to just do a backup restore. Oh, yeah. Okay. We'll have some fun with that. We'll wait a couple of days and I'm going to pop you again with a better one this time. Let's try a different flavor. Do you think that the interconnectivity is also causing a lot of grief? I mean, because now we're seeing more and more systems that are being bolted together, like you and I were talking about RACF earlier. Do you think that's a big part of the problem now?
That certainly does help with the spread, and people don't always have a lot of great controls. And, you know, talking about some of those larger mid-range mainframe-type systems that we spoke about earlier, you know, you may think that you have great controls up in the front-end application layer, but we continue to see that back-end user permissions and user access rules are not really being taken care of. The application developers are trying to do it. They're not doing it at the backside. So as soon as I get that foothold, I can run wild inside of those systems. Yep. And you know what a lot of those systems do best is encryption. So as soon as I can light up that fire, the encryption can run wild. And all of those fancy hot backups and disaster recovery sites are replicating those encrypted files just as fast as they can write them to the disk. So it really could make for a bad situation. And we continue to try and educate people on that, especially the importance around those vulnerability management programs, because none of this stuff is usually rocket science. It's missing patches, it's bad configurations, it's phishing emails for the main attack vectors that people are getting in on. It's not the light bulb and the optical sensor that you were talking about.
Right.
It's much simpler than that most of the time.
Why
because
bother?
It works.
Yeah, I mean, why do you need to do some fancy? I mean, I'm glad that University of Negev is exploring cool stuff like that, but I always called that the if there's two cars sitting on the street and one of them's got two rabid pit bulls in the back and one of them sitting there with the keys in the ignition, which one are you going to steal? Unless you just have a thing for pit bulls, I mean, you're probably going to take the one with the keys.
Yeah, we're seeing lots of increases of that now, too, with the whole work from home capabilities.
Oh, yeah.
More access being left open. I got to be able to get in. More users that are using personal devices or maybe not so tightly managed corporate devices anymore. I mean, they threw laptops at people and sent them home, or they just said, go light up your PC at home and use this VPN to get in. So being able to have visibility into that traffic as well. We've dealt with someone recently, you know, they lit up all those VPNs as soon as you set the system down and start looking at what's in there. people are doing things at home that they wouldn't do at work. They got Netflix on the side. They're reading their personal emails. If they get phished now on their personal account, it's bypassed all the corporate filters, but it's tied to that same traffic that goes into the network now, and it gives us that extra foothold to get through.
I agree. So the other day I made a statement and I said, you know, I think we won't be able to stop phishing. I mean, would you tend to agree with that?
I think I would tend to agree with that. They're always going to try. And today it's even easier just looking at situations around the world. I don't have to be that targeted right now. COVID, spray and pray. Why isn't my stimulus check here? What's going on with the latest protest? There's so many things now where you can just do a blanket send, get a few people to click on it. You don't have to get that big of a spear phishing attack and get so targeted anymore. So we really advocate for user education, teaching people not to click on links, hover over and see what it is, read that email. Those misspellings are probably not supposed to be there. It's, you know, the keys that you can look at, and starting to have those education programs so that people understand more and more what it is that they should be looking for, because those users are the, you know, the first line of defense to make sure that they just don't click on everything that comes across their desk.
But my assumption was they were still going to fail. I mean, I've been doing this literally the first time I ever did a phishing attack, and it was white. It was all white hat folks. Was in like 1986. So I was literally doing, I was just war dialing my employer and asking people for their credentials. So it was just straight up social engineering. And no matter how many times we told them that this could happen, and they still fell for it. I mean, not the first person or even the third person, but that, you know, fourth, fifth person, they go, oh, yeah, oh, my, let me give you my information, you know. And it was just like, oh, are you kidding me? I mean, I don't think we're going to stop it. So what's the next control? I mean, so let's just assume that that's a bust, that some user somewhere in the infinite pool of users is going to click the link. So what's the next control?
You know, eventually people are going to click. Something's going to get through the frontline defenses. And then we do need to have that back end detection and protection that we're looking at to figure out that somebody is in there now. And we need to kick them out, stop those things before they can turn into a ransomware attack or a large data breach. You know, we definitely do that here on our side at Core with network traffic analysis tools, where we can see what's going on inside of the network. So being able to understand that user behavior or that traffic is something that's malicious, so that we can, you know, have basically a failsafe on the backside to stop whatever gets through. Because we all know eventually something's going to find a hole. There's so many ways to get into the networks these days. You know, if all of our front-end protections were perfect, we'd never have a data breach. We know that's not what's happening. So we do have to have that back-end protection and make sure that we can see, you know, see within that traffic, see within that user behavior model, what's not right. You know, not trying to do baselines and checking what's going on, but actually live analysis of that traffic so we can see, we can prevent and lock out those systems as soon as we see what's happening there.
And I mean, does that work? I have sort of mixed feelings about sometimes that stuff. Are you fast enough, you know, are you going to be able to respond quickly enough to stop these things?
You know, it can be really, really fast. Sometimes it's slower, depending on what we're seeing. So if you've got an active live thing going on, it can be as few as a couple of packets to the wrong place to tell us what's going on, that you're communicating with a known CNC domain or a known malware author website type thing. So it can be really super quick. Sometimes it may take a little longer. You can have a lot of VMs these days where they're up for a little while, down, they come back up next week when I respin it to do something again. And you need to be able to also capture those long-running hosts that you can, you know, get a few packets, see if it comes back, get a few more, and you know that it's good. So it can be a really, really super quick process. And if you have the right type of information, you know, exactly what's the problem, where it is on the network, what it's talking with and communicating with. And we see many times things get through that aren't getting caught by traditional, you know, traditional malware defense, traditional firewalls. And that's why we have to have that extra capability to catch those things on the backside and pick those up before they become a huge infection and a big problem. And that also helps with, you know, as we talk about that spreading and cleaning, that's where it really helps us there. So we're seeing things that are getting spread across the network. We can still see them in an IoT device if they're hiding in the firmware on a Wi-Fi or a network printer. It doesn't have to be at an operating system level anymore. Running without agents lets you work on any device that's connected. And these days, almost everything is connected. So it missed maybe your fancy coffee maker that has a little light that says when the coffee's low, so you don't have to get up and go till someone else makes it. You know, we want to protect everything on the network.
All right. Thank you, Bob, for joining us. I'm glad you were here, and I appreciate your comments on ransomware. Finally, Spot is finally available for sale. No kidding. So Boston Dynamics robot dog, if you've never seen it, I know you've seen it. This thing's been making waves for a few years ever since it came out. There's a Black Mirror episode called Metalhead, which featured critters that looked an awful lot like Spot chasing people, which, of course, I don't think Boston Dynamics was probably real excited about that. And that didn't help, the image of their robot dog, which looked exactly like these really scary things that were in Black Mirror. I'm still waiting for Boston Dynamics to send me my demo, you know, guys, like any day now. Come on, like I wouldn't mind. But apparently, the dog is now available for sale to commercial and industrial use customers in the United States. It was available in other programs abroad. But you have to sign a clause, wait for it, that you won't use it to harm people or simulate harming people. Mm-hmm. And I promise I won't do evil with this. No way. So apparently Asimov's rules do not apply here. Please send me one. I want one so bad, please. And that's the news for now. In the time of plague, I'm Doug White. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Security Weekly News. I'll be back this week on Thursday with the Security Weekly News wrap-up show. Stay safe and read the science.